It's 4 o'clock, and this is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Stay tuned for Express Yourself, coming right up here on KDNK. Yeah, I got that feeling. Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, 7 revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nestler, and that was the Lowdown Brass Band with their song, I Got That Feeling. That'll get you moving. Well, the Lowdown Brass Band hails from Chicago, and yet, as you can hear, has strong roots in the New Orleans second line tradition. The Lowdown Brass Band kicks off a month-long music series at Justice Snow's in Aspen next Wednesday, March 1st. And with me now by telephone from the Front Range is Dave Levine of the Lowdown Brass Band. Welcome, Dave.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
Oh, doing great. We just we pulled into Denver, I would say, early this afternoon from Chicago after driving all night and getting our bearings and getting ready to launch some great shows, hopefully.
That's at least a 16-hour drive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a doozy.
Yeah. Well, I'm just glad that you weren't driving west into a gathering storm. Or were
indeed,
you?
Indeed. Well, we were, anyway.
Oh, okay. But that's
enough. We just kept coming.
Yeah, just like your band.
Well, that's right.
Just keeps coming at you with all those horns. Now, I watched a lot of videos of the Lowdown Brass Band, and it looks like there's anywhere from a 5 to an 8-piece that you guys are configured. What's your touring configuration on your little Colorado tour here?
We'll have 8 for the most part.
Uh-huh.
We're picking up, I think we'll actually have 7 maybe tonight. But yeah, we're picking up 8 for the duration of the tour. So we'll have, for the most part, a stock 7-person band with an MC. So that's kind of how we roll when we're on tour.
So that's 2 trombones, 2 trumpets, sousaphone. How many saxophones?
Saxophone, drummer, and MC. So yeah, that rounds out the 8.
Oh, how about that? Huh. You know, there's something powerful about a lot of horns playing together. And if, you know, with 8 pieces, that's a lot of arranging to do, isn't it?
Oh yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. There's a real great cast of characters in the group have been, we've been together for 13 years now, mostly as a solid crew, I would say, for the last 8 or so years. A lot of talented composers and arrangers and, you know, instrumentalists and soloists and the whole 9. So we're lucky to have, guys that really know their way around, arranging and composing. And we do some stuff on the fly as well. So as you can imagine, after 8 years, we've established some chemistry along the way, and we can kind of channel some group think from time to time, hive mind or whatever you want to call it. But we're just lucky to have some really talented cats in the band doing a lot of the writing.
So you give yourselves room to improvise.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A huge staple of, New Orleans music and jazz music and a lot of the music that we love is spontaneous and, as is life. So we kind of just take the impulse and run with it.
Well, as I said, you're based in Chicago, but this is the first whiff of the Lowdown Brass Band I've gotten out here in the Rockies. Are you starting to tour nationally, or have you been doing that for a while?
We're starting a little bit more. We made our first kind of foray out last summer and did some gigs for the most part in Denver. But we're making our way through the mountains into some ski towns, this time through and in our kind of mountain Mardi Gras tour, which we were really excited and looking forward to for a long time. So, yeah, we're hoping to make it more of a regular thing. And if we can build, a little fan base out here, we'd love to keep coming.
I would think that you could make a really profitable little tour in all the Colorado ski towns, especially since you can service your music to community radio stations in all those ski towns. And that's probably a ready audience for you, I would think.
Yeah, we hope so. I mean, we like to think that we've got a pretty wide appeal, from, 9 months to 99. I feel like it's just the music in general, it's got so many different influences. It's got a wide appeal. It touches a lot of different people in different ways. And so we're lucky enough to, be able to have that thread where people can, they're really engaged by our music and we're happy to bring it to them for sure.
And these are mostly originals?
Yeah, I would say a good 85-90% original.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to throw in some of the tunes that we just love.
Like what? Just curious.
We're super proud to have collaborated with Roy Ayers on our last album in his kind of seminal classic, Everybody Loves the Sunshine. So, we featured that on the last album. We're doing a collaboration. This is more of an original tune, but we're doing a collaboration with a bounce MC from New Orleans named Ricky B. But some other covers we've done, Concrete Jungle by Bob Marley, Let It Whip by the Dad Band. We've got some Hall & Oates. We've got some Michael Jackson, our, you know, of course, we've got to play some Chicago. If we're from Chicago.
Okay.
You know, very important horn band of the 70s and 80s. So, yeah, a lot of influences. I mean, we're doing a lot of hip hop stuff, West Coast, Dr. Dre, Nate Dogg, you know, you name it. We're all over the map.
Well, based on my viewing of those videos, I'm guessing that it's a ready collaboration with talented MCs, because there's such a steady presence of horns behind. You know, it's not based on a screaming guitar or wizardry on the keyboards. It's all horns, and that gives a lot of room to an MC to really do his thing.
Sure, yeah, and it adds, I mean, it's a different color. Not many, you know, MCs are used to working like that, but ours, Billa Camp, has been masterful, and we've added him full-time, I would say, for the last, just before the last album came out. So that was in 2014, so he's been a steady fixture for the last few years, and the band has really, you know, evolved to another level with him added to the mix. Just really opens a lot of possibilities, and he's a great collaborator visually, you know, with photo and video, and you know, he adds another cog to the wheel as far as, like, you know, our kind of internal business machine. You know, we're all DIY, so we're our own booking agency and label, and, you know, producers and lawyers and accountants, and we've got to do all those jobs. So he fits in really great in our little organization.
And you say you've been around doing this for 8 years. Well, I heard you say 8 years, and then I heard you say 13. So you must be doing something right.
Yeah, we're trying. But yeah, it started 13 years ago. But I would say within the last eight is kind of been our fixed lineup. A little bit more focus on the business end, being a, you know, a working band, and just what that entails as far as, like, just trying to do the work, put your name out there, make new recordings, hit the road, play as many shows as you can, make more recordings, you know, just kind of funnel things back into the band, and you know, it's not glamorous, and it's not, you know, overnight success, but it's a slow and steady climb for us, and we hope that it continues.
Well, it sure sounds good, and I know there are a lot of people in a lot of ski towns looking forward to a little second line dancing and some Mardi Gras music coming our way. So
yeah, it's Mardi Gras. It's time to get it in.
Yeah, except you're playing Aspen the day after Mardi Gras, so aren't you supposed to do penance or something?
It's a whole. You know, it's a whole spirit. You know, we don't want to get bogged down in technicality.
So. Okay. Well, Dave Levine,
we'll
I want to
forget that little day on the calendar.
Okay. Yeah, we'll save the ashes for another day.
Absolutely.
Hey, Dave Levine, I want to thank you for joining us here on KDNK and telling us a little bit about the Lowdown Brass Band. And we'll see you next Wednesday up in Aspen.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Looking forward to it.
All righty. Have a great day.
Okay. Take care.
That's Dave Levine of the Lowdown Brass Band here on KDNK. And as I said, they're kicking off the Americana series of Justice Snow starting next Wednesday, March 1st. Lowdown Brass Band at Justice Snow's. All right, stay tuned. We have more to come on today's Express Yourself. We're back, and it's the Express Yourself show here on KDNK. Rosie Bell is the new Mobile Maker Bus from Carbondale Arts. KDNK DJ Kat Rich has been named the coordinator of the project, and she sat down with station manager Gavin Dahl recently to talk about it. She starts by explaining what Rosie Bell is and where the name came from.
Rosie Bell is a memorial project in honor of CCAH, or Carbondale Arts, former director, Ro Mead. And one of Ro Mead's passions was making sure that all children of all types in all places had access to arts education. And when she passed away, it was very hard for us to come up with a project that Ro felt that was worthy of her memorial. And this bus was the ticket, and that was what we were able to come up with for her memorial project. And it is named the Rosie Bell after Ro Mead, and that is also Amy Kimberly's nickname for Ro. So it's really exciting to be a part of that project because Ro was a mentor to me and a very, very dear friend. And Ro had a really big influence on so many people in this community, but especially in making sure that arts education was brought here and that it stayed here.
And so folks may have seen the bus parked around town. What do you have planned for the physical space?
Well, we have ripped out all the seats, and except for one for the bus driver and one for the teacher that will ride in the bus. And they have taken everything out. They have put in a series of tables where there will be 10 to 12 workstations that will have laptops that are retrofitted with music, video, film, photo editing equipment, you know, the works. We will have sort of the back is retrofitted to be kind of a safe space area that we can clear out for performance work or movement type work, or if a kid needs a place to just have a minute to collect themselves or just take a minute and have some space. So we'll have an area for that. And we are waiting to have the solar panels. We got a grant from CORE, and so Rosie Bell will be fully solar panel operated, which is great. We will have a backup generator. And we're just in the process of trying to develop the outer design for the wrap. From what I understand, an artist will come up with a concept for a design, and then we'll take it to the wrap people, which is basically a giant sticker that they're going to put on the outside of the bus. So that's where we are sort of in the construction phase.
Then what do you have planned for the coming months? Once Rosie Bell is up and running, what's the plan of action?
Our plan right now is to initiate sort of a soft opening kind of test run for Rosie Bell with the RE1 school district, which is Carbondale, Basalt, Glenwood Springs, in the springtime. So we can really work on developing programming that is consistent with the school's curriculums. It's really important to maintain a cross-curricular balance. And what that means for folks that aren't in the education know is if there is a class that is learning something about bugs, say, we will work with that teacher to come up with an art project or a creative endeavor that allows them to study more about that particular subject, which is a really exciting thing. And it's a great way to utilize the partnerships that we're hoping to develop between all of the schools.
And kind of augment curriculum mm-hmm. in a kind of a fluid way.
Yeah, exactly. In a mobile way, exactly. And then our plan in the summertime is to get some camps out to the Western Corridor schools, which is Newcastle, Rifle, Parachute. That's the RE2 school district. And currently, the RE2 school district only has enough funding to operate on a 4-day school week, which is a little unfortunate for the kids and for the school system. But our plan is to utilize that fifth day on Fridays and bring the Rosie Bell bus to those underserved areas so that we can initiate some programming, give them what we call a third space, which is not school, not home, but it's a place for kids and youth to go that will provide them tools, access to creative endeavors, social skills, et cetera, et cetera. So our plan is to have some camps initiated with the RE2 school district this summer. And then once fall rolls around, Rosie Bell will be fully equipped and programmed and ready to go to serve all the schools in RE2 and RE1.
Talking to Kat Rich, the coordinator of Rosie Bell, the new mobile maker bus from Carbondale Arts, you mentioned the CORE grant. You've just received another grant for this project too, right?
Yes, we are very, very fortunate to have received a grant from the Gerentz Foundation. And that is a family up in Aspen whose sister was an artist, and it was very important to her to keep arts education going as well. We've also just received another grant from the Betty Jane Schuss Foundation. And the grants from the Schuss Foundation and the Grants Foundation will help us to acquire our technology, which is part of the integral mission of this bus, is to offer these children access to music, video, film, spoken word, the higher technology, and the digital arts.
And so then talk more about your role as coordinator. What are some of the collaborations you're planning to develop besides what you've talked about?
Well, my job is to facilitate all kinds of interesting pieces and parts of this project. And as I'm going along, it's a big project and there's a lot of logistics that pop up. So that's a little overwhelming, but it's very exciting also because there's all sorts of things you haven't thought of. It's our hope that maybe eventually that this project will take off so well that we'll have a fleet of Rosie Bells maybe someday because the need will be that great. But what I am currently doing is working on building policies and setting up some partnerships and some collaborations with some other organizations that are dedicated to helping youth, particularly Andy Zanka Youth Empowerment Program, Youth Entity, Access Roaring Fork. We're working on partnering with them for some of their summer boost camps this summer to offer some enrichment. We are working on building partnerships with Jazz Aspen to work on Beats Lab, working on facilitating partnerships with Aspen Word so we can incorporate some spoken word into these things. There are so many arts organizations that we're working on trying to build partnerships, and that's so wonderful for us to be in this community that's so saturated with this artistic talent.
And also libraries and nonprofits. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like the list could kind of go on from there.
Yeah, and we're currently building our partnerships with the RE1 and RE2 school districts, as well as the public libraries, the park systems. So the possibilities for this bus, I think, are pretty endless, which is very exciting.
And then for folks who have heard you DJ or have seen you around at Mountain Fair or something, but don't know your background, you are an artist and you have a master's in arts administration.
Yes, I do. I just recently got my diploma in the mail a few weeks ago, and I just graduated with a degree in arts administration and nonprofit management through the University of Denver. In my former life, before I came back to Carbondale, I was a kindergarten, first, second, and third grade teacher.
I did not know that.
That was my former life. And I helped develop some curriculums for some schools at the Parker School in Hawaii on the Big Island. They developed a lower school program, and I was fortunate enough to be the first grade teacher of that program. So I have a little bit of education background. I am a fledgling artist, still learning myself, which is exciting. And to draw back a little bit to Roe Mead, I got into art as a form of therapy and never planned on people seeing it. And Roe saw a piece of my work, and anyone that knows her will really appreciate the statement. She made me, I literally mean made me, put this piece of art on the wall. And that changed my whole life as an artist. So I feel that Roe is a very big part in my artistic journey. So that's another piece of this pie that makes me really proud to be a part of the project.
I've heard that you do collage and also screen printing.
Collage, printmaking, and I'm learning how to do some screen printing. I set up a project this summer with a design I did up at Anderson Ranch that had a Volkswagen Bug on it, and somebody said you should put that on a t-shirt. So I hooked up with Raina Katzenberger over at Max Inc., the project shop, and she set me up with screen printing equipment and turned it into sort of a bigger endeavor than I had planned. But screen printing, collage, some painting, but I'm still finding my feet.
Well, it sounds like Rosie Bell is got a very bright future ahead of it. And it's so exciting to hear that folks in local foundations and probably individual Carbondale Arts donors as well are starting to pick up on that this is a project that's in need of support. And you're already showing that kind of growth toward your vision. And we're kind of catching an exciting moment, right, as it's all happening.
Yeah, this is a really exciting time. And once again, we're very fortunate and very grateful to have such a supportive community of just individuals and donors and businesses that are all very interested in this project. They all see the need for this bus, and we've been very lucky so far to have such great support from all of these individuals, organizations, foundations, etc. This project is ongoing, though, so we will always need to find ways to keep this project funded. So that's something else that, as the project develops, that I will become more instrumental in working on grant applications and things. But Amy Kimberly at Carbondale Arts is fantastic at seeing a need for something and going out and finding people to believe in it and fund it. So we're very lucky to have Amy behind this vision as well.
Kat Rich, new coordinator of the Rosie Bell Mobile Makerspace from Carbondale Arts. Thanks for speaking with Katie and Kay.
Thank you, Gavin.
We'll see you on the airwaves.
Toot toot.
Kat Rich, off the wagon and on the bus. Kidding. Stay with us. More to come on Express Yourself. Lon Winston has labored more than 20 years building Thunder River Theater into a respected regional theater and a consistent producer of quality theatrical performance in the Lower Valley. Lon takes a third stab at directing Shakespeare for Thunder River with The Tempest, which opens tonight and runs through the next two weekends until March 11th. I caught up with Lon last Tuesday to talk about The Tempest and about his own legacy at Thunder River Theater. Joining the program now is Lon Winston. Hi, well, Lon.
Well, hi, Luke.
What's your official title? Retired.
You know, as I said to Will Grandbois yesterday, you know, that there is no such thing of retiring from the theater. You just change what you do. And I'm in a lovely position of being able to just stay focused on the art, which I love. And I said that it's the first time in 22 years since I founded Thunder River, directing The Tempest, that I'm directing and designing the play. I'm not doing the poster, doing the program, doing the press releases, making sure ticket sales, press releases, cleaning the building, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's just doing the art, and I love it.
Is that going to elevate things for you, do you think?
You know, I think what it does is it takes a lot of the stress away, and I've noticed on this show each day I go home, I wake up in the morning, I'm not running down to the theater to take care of things. I'm reading the script, I'm studying it, I'm thinking about the actors and things that I need to share with them. It just opens up a different channel.
This is the third time you've directed Shakespeare for Thunder River Theater?
Yes, this is the third Shakespeare production. We did Macbeth, we did Hamlet 2 years ago, and now I'm doing The Tempest.
Why The Tempest?
Well, you know, interesting. It's rooted in mythos. It's mystical. It's magical. It deals with human nature and human condition in a really interesting way. The play thematically is about reconciliation, forgiveness, all those sweet things, but in Prospero, the lead character, there is this need to vent. There's a need to make people pay first before he forgives them. That's interesting to me, not only from a national picture, but, you know, when you people are quick to say, oh, forgiveness, peace, love, Woodstock, streets to the people. But there's this niggling thing inside people that when they're hurt, when they've been made to suffer, there is a retribution that just is deep seated in people. That interests me. Mm-hmm. And it's in the play.
It is in the play, isn't it? Big time.
Yeah, So I'm looking at that. I'm working on that. I'm bringing it out through magic and mysticism, and it's exciting. It's exciting to work on. And it was Shakespeare's swan song. I mean, you know, it really was the last play that's attributed to the person we call Shakespeare. Whether or not he wrote the play or who wrote the plays, it's the last one that's attributed to that.
And I know down the centuries, some critics have said that Prospero is Shakespeare.
You know, there are many, many articles in critical review that people have discussed that that's part of it. One of the things that interests me in the play is that that very well may be true, albeit I'm an Oxfordian. I believe that there are other people who contributed greatly to the writing of the plays. But that's certainly part of it.
Well, being Shakespeare's final play, is there a sense, how can I put this? Obviously, his plays have dealt with themes, universal human themes, all of it, Macbeth, Hamlet, the histories, all of it. Is there a sense in The Tempest that he came to any conclusions about what a wondrous work mankind is?
You know, it's I think that any time you delve into a play, especially plays that are old on the chronological line of plays, that you've got to come at a play from a personal point of view. Sam Shepard, a playwright, actor, director, said, "If it's not personal, why do it in art?" And that's interesting to me too. In reading the play, there are things that are that jump out at me. One of the things that I've believed in studying this play for many, many, many years are the characters of Prospero, but also Ariel and Caliban, the two that inhabit the island with Prospero and, of course, his daughter Miranda. But I've always thought of Prospero, Ariel, and Caliban as a tripartite person. That Ariel, as the heir, the sprite, is part of Prospero. And that Caliban, the carnal, threatening Miranda, that's part of Prospero. Those are other sides of him that in the magic he's able to separate from himself and then look at it and examine it from outside, looking in instead of from the inside, looking out.
He employs those spirits in the story.
Yeah. Yeah,
they are his assistants.
They are his assistants, which, and throughout, rooted in the text, are lines that let you believe that these are really parts of him that he is questioning, that he is looking at, that he's examining, and that's intellectually and creatively inspires me as I work on the play.
John Gielgud said that Prospero was his favorite role.
Well,
why would he say that?
Well, because I think it's so complex in all the, I mean, and you end up at the end of the play being able to forgive. You know, the other characters in Shakespeare's plays don't always have that opportunity. And so there is the magical aspect of it. You know, I've seen over the years films of The Tempest. And, you know, in film, you can do magic in incredible ways, you know, playing with the film. In the theater, you've got to create a whole different kind of theatricality to be with people sitting right there 5 feet away from you. It's not sleight of hand magic. It's a It's a special milieu that you create inside the theater that you hope everybody can just let themselves go into. And so playing Prospero, especially live, and Gielgud is talking about playing that character live, and people are right there viscerally feeling all that he's doing, and that is special.
Well, he starts off as a not entirely sympathetic character, so there's a character development arc in the play, because at the end he does forgive his enemies and he renounces his magic too.
Well, he does. He puts it down finally because he knows he's going home, but he also manipulates and controls this wreck of the ship to bring everybody together where he can really find the way to make each person pay the price for having put him in this predicament for the past 12 years. Even Gonzalo, who saved Prospero and Miranda's life by making sure that when they set them on their little boat, just pushed them out to sea, to die would everybody, his brother Antonio and the king, although we've changed it to a queen, I've cast it as a woman. those characters really thought that Prospero and Miranda were going to be gone and they'd never have to deal with that, especially in at that time when retribution of family members. I mean, you took out somebody that the next born was going to make sure you paid the price. You know, that was just all part of what they did. So Gonzalo, who helped them, gave them food and books and clothing and made sure Prospero had everything that he needed on that boat, that if luck would have it, he would be able to use. Gonzalo's on this ship now. And Gonzalo has to go through the same kind of pain and suffering as everybody else until the very end when he realizes that Prospero's there to thank him and love him up, you know? So.
I'm interested in that relationship between Caliban and Ariel and Prospero.
Well, it's
symbolically and realistically in the play too. It's a very complex relationship.
And that's why over the years, even when I was still teaching at the university and teaching the plays and talking about them on these different levels, that the idea of it being a tripartite character always interested me. And there are things in the play, there are lines rooted in the text that support that. It's not just, you know, imagining it, but it's metaphor for me. And actors can't act metaphor. You've got to create. Still, Ariel and Caliban and Prospero are very different characters on stage. But there are moments where you realize that Prospero suffers from this complexity, and that he deals with these things. I mean, let's just take Caliban, who is child of a witch, Sycorax,
and the devil,
and exactly. And, you know, he's been after threatening Miranda from the time she was a little girl. And that is very disturbing to not only Prospero, but to Miranda herself, who gains strength to actually address that in the play. But when you're the father and the 15-year-old daughter, who's a woman now at that period of time, they're the only ones on the island in terms of the human species. And so there's that aloneness, that dark side of the human being, the needs that people have. And that's a dangerous piece of territory. And we've talked about that at great length in rehearsal, how Prospero, his overzealousness and wanting to take Caliban down is that piece of human nature that might very well be part of Prospero's dark side. It's like the two, the devil and the angel on each shoulder whispering in your ear, to Jiminy Cricket. So it's got a lot of history in there and a lot of complexity in the language and the ideas. And I think it's helped us to bring a theatrical life to the play that is exciting. I don't like just doing Shakespeare. I like doing with Shakespeare.
Oh, interesting. Doing with.
Yeah, I like deconstructing the play, which I've done on this. I did it on Hamlet. I did it on Macbeth. I take the play apart. I put it back together in a way that tells the story through our actors, the way we develop the characters. And there's some surprises in our production, which the audience is going to see right off the bat if they're familiar with the play. Even if they're not familiar with the play, but they've heard the story, there are elements for me as a director and designer that I like to open up a different door so that people experience the play in a new and fresh way, that it is new for today's audience, and that they get something maybe more out of the play than they've, people have thought about it for the last 500 years. So that's very interesting to me in that exploration. I don't like historical accuracy. For me as an artist, Luke, I'm not interested in, taking a Shakespeare play and just for the hell of it, sticking it in 1812 or the Civil War or, and War of Independence. They all stand up because they're universal. I like anachronism. I like bringing in images of today into the play so that the audience just doesn't look at a historical play and think that it's all about those people, but rather all this human nature and development in the human condition is really about us as we watch it and we become part of it, not just sort of observers on the side.
So let's talk about the cast. Who is playing Prospero?
Well, Prospero is Jeff Carlson.
Jeff Carlson.
Jeff has been with me for a long time. He played the lead in Lillian Hellman's Little Foxes before we ever had the theater. He was Macbeth in Macbeth. He was in The Cherry Orchard. He played George in Virginia Woolf. He's been with me for a while, and he's done some major roles. And it's that when I did Hamlet, I said to everybody, "You don't do Hamlet if you don't have a Hamlet." David Pulliam played Hamlet; he was a company member. For me, David is Hamlet, so that's why I chose to do Hamlet. Well, the same thing. I called Jeff and a year and a half ago, and I said, "I'm thinking of doing The Tempest next year, Prospero." And I mean, there was no hesitation. Yeah.
that familiarity you have with him and he with you, does that pay dividends in the play? I'll bet it does.
Oh, absolutely. We trust each other implicitly. We've worked on some pretty difficult pieces of literature. And to have that kind of bond between an actor and a director, you know, you read about it all the time. There are actors who have done films with Scorsese or any filmmaker, and they want to do another one. People that have been in a Woody Allen play, they want to do another one with Woody Allen because there's a bond that gets established, and Jeff and I have that bond. And I know that when I share ideas with him, that he goes home, he researches it, he thinks about it, he puts it together. I mean, he wrote a spectacular backstory about Prospero and where he came from. And that's part of an actor's responsibility. That's not mine. I'm dealing with the play from the page one to page 100. You know, so they need to know, well, who am I before this play even starts? And often, who am I after the play is over? My pre-life and my post-life, and Jeff is thorough that way. Trary, Madelone, who's she's been around for a long time. Maurice LeMay, her husband, who was head of Aspen Writers and ran the Creed Repertory Theater for years. You know, they were in the very first Thunder River Theater Company production when I founded it 22 years ago. And to have Trary, who plays Ariel, be with me on opening night and the dedication of the renaming of the theater. And she was in the very first play, and she's going to be there on stage. That's really neat. And I played opposite her 2 years ago in Lion in Winter, which was fun to do. So, again, there's a trust, you know, from years of work and professional understanding of the art and the craft. Nathan Cox plays Caliban. Nathan is really a kind of musical theater background, and I cast him in Rashomon. He played Taj Maru, the bandit. And it was a step outside that musical theater for him. Well, he loved it. And then he was in Jekyll and Hyde, and now he's in this. And we have also established that kind of actor-director bond. Owen O'Farrell is playing Trinculo, and Gerald DeLisser, is playing Stefano. These people, Nick Gray is playing Ferdinand. These people have been working with me for years.
Huh. Is there a generally understood implicit challenge in doing Shakespeare?
You know,
to an actor or to a director?
Yes. Yeah, I think there is. First of all, it's doing a play in a foreign language. So, you know, it's really difficult for people sometimes to wrap their mind around the language. They sit in the theater and they hear it, and it's in a different language. And you pick up a word or, you know, it's like studying, if you were studying Spanish and somebody, you know, said to you, in Spanish, I'm going to pour milk on your head. And you heard the word leche, you know, and you smile because you got that word, you know, and you go, yeah, and they pour milk on your head. So it's, you know, it's difficult for people to sit and watch Shakespeare. I think that people do it because it's taken on a mythos in Western civilization. Culturally, we go to Cedar City and Oregon Shakespeare Festival and Chicago Shakespeare, and we want to see great actors play these roles, and it's work. It's not like, you know, just sitting through a Tennessee Williams or an Arthur Miller. You got to work at it.
So there's an understanding among the actors that they're standing there orating in blank verse, but they have to connect with a modern audience. So that's the challenge.
It's a huge challenge, yes. And in a way, and I said this to Will yesterday in an interview for the Sopra Sun, that it's part, I see it as part of my responsibility to create a theatrical milieu that allows the audience to get what's going on, even if they don't get every line, because I create iconic images on stage and do all these things that they get it. They see the play begin, the play ends. You see the tension and the diversity in emotions that are riveting the characters together. And if they're honest and it's authentic and they're engaged, then the audience is experiencing the play more than just intellectually. They're feeling it. They're seeing things that they recognize in their own life. They see the behaviors. They go, ooh, I've seen that person. And so there's an identity, there's a frame of reference that you can attach yourself to. And that's, for me, that's part of my job as a director. And that's why I say, and it doesn't matter if it's just Shakespeare, really it's every play I direct that I do with the play, not just do the play.
That's really interesting. Well, you made a brief mention of an important facet of opening night, and that is the renaming of the theater in your honor.
Wow.
And that's really something.
It is. It's
that is such stuff as dreams are made of.
That's right. That's right. I think of that every night when Prospero says those lines. It's amazing, and I'm honored, and I'm so proud of it. I'm so committed to our community. I mean, I've been living in the Valley for 40 years. Even though I left for a little while to Villanova, but I kept my place here, thank God. I'm committed to Carbondale. I mean, school board, SCI board, BOCES, the Board of Cooperative Educational Services, Arts Council board for 12 years, eight as the president when Thomas was still here. And that, so to have, for me to have been able to raise the money and build this theater and leave that as a legacy for our community. I don't ever want it to be dentist offices. I want it to always be doing theater. Mm-hmm. And in today's technological world, if we don't hang on to that live theater, we're going to lose a huge piece of our soul. And so the performing arts are important to me. I'm honored that the board wanted to rename the theater as I stepped back from the leadership role, even though I'm still on the board. I stepped back from that leadership role, giving, to another generation to move forward with a new vision, maybe. Honoring the historical precedent of the kind of work that people are used to seeing at Thunder River. So it is, it makes me really, really proud. So many people are responsible for Thunder River being where it's at today. It's not just me, but I love the idea of that black box being called the Lon Winston
I'll
Theater.
I'll bet. I would say it's a fitting legacy. I mean, you created something where nothing existed.
Yeah, it was a mud hole over there. Now
it's an amazing thing, dude. I mean, over and above just the building, the idea, everything associated with it. You had to build an audience to come to your
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for the first, 10 years, 11 years, Thunder River traveled up and down the valley in an 18-wheeler and unloaded all our chairs and platforms wherever we could get a space to perform. And people are going, whoa, this is good stuff. And pretty soon you build that audience and, it's like the field of dreams, build it and they will come. And we have we have that audience.
What an amazing thing. And The Tempest starting this weekend, running
Friday. Through. It opens Friday night, preview Thursday, but it opens Friday. We're totally sold out for opening. I have friends from all over coming in for it because of the dedication and everything. And Saturday, and then the following Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then the following Thursday through Sunday, through Saturday. We have two high school matinees that we're doing, totally sold out. So that I'm so committed to education in the Valley, and so I'm thrilled that we're doing that, and they get to experience the play, and you know it's going to be way different than what they read in the script in their classes. You know, and they're going to go, wow. I hope, you know, that's the plan.
Must be fun to watch those kids' eyes light up.
Like, yeah, I think so. Thing. I think so. I think you, when we get kids over to the theater to watch our productions and talk about them afterwards with them, Death of a Salesman, I mean, just lots of different work that we've presented and then sit and talk with them afterwards. They're incredible what they see and experience, and from their frame of reference and point of view. I learn something more about the plays sometimes through those younger people. And we've got to get them into the theater, because if we don't get those young people into the theater and put those phones down and really digest and assimilate live performance, it's going to go the way of other things.
Yeah. Hey, Juan Winston, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Juan Winston, director of The Tempest at Thunder River Theater, whose opening night is tonight. You can visit thunderrivertheater.com for tickets and information. And you can also find my complete conversation with Juan at KDNK.org. Thanks for listening. Please remember to go out there and express yourself.